Welcome back. Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. In January, social media giant Facebook announced it would ban the sale of guns and ammunition on its network. But firearm sales have continued on the site, in part because one of the Facebook's own employees is an unofficial advocate for gun enthusiasts. Joining us now to discuss it is technology writer for Forbes, Matt Drange. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Can you tell us about how Facebook came to ban firearms sales on their site in the first place?
Sure, yeah. So gun sales have been happening on Facebook for years. They're nothing new. And Facebook really decided to ban private party sales for a couple reasons. One, they were getting a lot of pressure from gun violence prevention advocacy groups, like Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, Every Town for Gun Safety, groups like that. We're meeting with Facebook and calling them and writing to them saying, hey, we would really like it if you would ban gun sales on the site. We see a lot of them happening. And the other reason Facebook decided to make this decision is that they are increasingly an e-commerce platform. Many people don't necessarily think of the site as being such right now. But you know, users can exchange payment directly via Messenger, and there are ads for just about anything you can imagine on the site. And so those two things were really why Facebook decided in January to say we're banning the private party sale of guns.
Do we have any idea how many guns, how many firearms were being sold before the ban went into place?
You know, we have an idea in the sense of, you know, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of gun enthusiast groups around the country, many that are, you know, primarily or at least in some part dedicated to the sale of guns. But, you know, Facebook does not know exactly how many guns change hands on the site, and they wouldn't tell us that. So, you know, we know it's a large number, but we don't know exactly how many.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about Facebook's policy regarding the sale of firearms on its site. My guest is Matt Drange. He's a technology writer for Forbes. He's written about it recently, and we'll have a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Matt Drange, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. One reason the policy is, well, first of all, how do we measure whether it's been successful or not? What's going on?
Yeah, so I mean, the easiest way to measure if it's successful, right, is if gun sales are still happening or not. Facebook does not want users to be able to sell guns directly to one another on the site. And the reason is that in most states, private party sales are unregulated. That is, you know, if I own a gun and I want to sell it to you, depending on the state we live in, I don't have to conduct a background check in order to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So the most obvious way to see if it's a success or not is to see if there are still sales happening, and there are many sales still happening. I get notifications every day of sales in many different groups that are taking place.
And one reason you wrote about that the policy has failed is that Facebook relies on users to flag banned content, right?
Yes, that's correct. So Facebook doesn't have any active enforcement of this policy. In other words, the company is not, you know, going out and trying to flag sales on the site on its own. They only look into groups or posts if they're brought to their attention by other users.
And could they take a more active approach?
They could. So one of the things that a lot of folks who study this have suggested to me as a possible solution to this would be to use image recognition on photos. So, you know, Facebook already has some of the best and brightest minds in the world when it comes to image recognition. People who have you know, advanced all sorts of things. You know, if you upload a photo, for example, to the site, it'll suggest, you know, that you tag your friends based on that person's face and who it thinks it might be. And so one way that people have suggested Facebook could improve enforcement or active enforcement, that is, of the ban would be to apply that to guns in a similar way that the site already does to things like child pornography, for example.
Now, another issue is that Facebook allows users to create secret groups. Are you talking about closed groups there?
So there's actually a distinction between those two. So a closed group would be, you know, you could look the group up and say, okay, you know, here's the group name, here's the purpose of the group. But a secret group isn't publicly indexed, so you can't actually go and look it up unless you're already a member of it.
Well, why do they let them do those groups?
That's a question for Facebook. I don't know the answer. I mean, there are lots of groups that, you know, friends might want to have for, some neighborhood setting, some school setting, any sort of business setting where you don't want outsiders to see what's going on. You know, you just want some privacy.
Mm-hmm.
These groups weren't set up, specifically to enable gun sales or anything like that. It's just that many gun enthusiast groups that were closed before have now gone to secret. And in that way, they can avoid any sort of outside scrutiny as long as they don't allow members in who might report posts.
Can even are those secret even to Facebook?
So Facebook, there are a small group of employees at Facebook who have the ability to view content in secret groups, but they told me that they don't go and do that unless, again, there is some group brought to their attention. If it's flagged, yeah.
Huh. So what are some other ways that gun sellers get around the ban?
Yeah, so there are some kind of funny ways. One way that I've seen a lot lately is users posting photos of guns next to other objects. You know, so an AR-15 rifle on a pile of bed sheets, and the post says that the bed sheets are for sale for $1,000. high capacity.
Some are that expensive, by the way. But go on.
Right. There certainly are. There aren't, however, at least that I know of. You know, another one I saw was Kansas soda for $1,000.
Okay.
I don't know of any Kansas soda for $1,000.
Right.
So that's one way. Another way that gun sellers are trying to get around sales is by posting a photo of their gun and saying PM me at a specific time of day. So if they say PM me at 8:50 p.m., they're not actually saying call them at 8:50 p.m. What they're saying is private message them about the gun. It's for sale for $850. And so there's sort of coded language that goes on in a lot of these groups where it's obvious to anyone. And I messaged many of these sellers directly to confirm this, that it's obvious what's happening. But if you just look at it from face value, you might not know if you're an outsider to the group.
Now, this all tells me they're going to so much trouble that it's a big deal for gun sales, for gun sellers, to be able to use Facebook.
Absolutely. It's a huge marketplace. There are many, many users. I mean, there are 1.6 billion users on the site. Really, some of these groups have gone to other sites, but really the reason they want to stay on Facebook is because it's the most exposure for them. So in some of these groups, these gun enthusiast groups with tens of thousands of members, if you list a gun for sale, you're going to have a lot of people see that. And if you're a seller, that's advantageous, right? You want more potential buyers.
So these aren't secret groups you're talking about. These are the ones that are closed or open groups, have tens of thousands of members.
So some of those same groups have gone to secret. So I've been a member of many of the groups, including secret ones, like the one that Facebook's engineer runs. But some of the groups are closed and some are secret. It just depends on the group.
Right. So you mentioned that their director of engineering, Chuck Rossi, is a known gun enthusiast, and you're saying he runs a secret group himself.
That's right. Yeah. So he asked a couple of very active page administrators to set up this group back in February, about a week after Facebook announced it was banning private party gun sales on the site.
So he's breaking his employer's own ban.
His stated, goal of setting up this group isn't to break a ban. It's to give groups an opportunity to get back into compliance. However, as a result of getting some of these groups back online, he has perhaps unwittingly undermined Facebook's ban. In other words, some of these groups that he brings back on, they're continuing to sell guns just as they were before. And I was not able to find any evidence that either Chuck or Facebook, anyone else at Facebook, is actually going back to these groups to making sure they're getting into compliance once they're brought back.
So is his role in advocating for gun sales simply that he's created that secret group?
So he's created the group. He's advocated internally at the company, on the engineering team to both bring pages back and also advocated for changes in the policy. He's been very active since Facebook announced this, and he's been very open about his feelings about it, saying that he feels it was rolled out poorly, that it caught a lot of groups who were primarily not selling, but actually just discussing guns off guard. And he's trying to change the policy. So one of the things he wants to change is to make it so that it does not include parts which it doesn't in writing, but Facebook publicly has said they also don't want to encourage the sale or facilitate the sale of parts either. So he's also working on it from a policy perspective. It's just that all this work is unofficial. In other words, he's not doing it at the request of his bosses, at least not that I know of.
So was this decision by Facebook in January, was it abrupt? Was it a surprise?
It was the long time in the making, actually. So Facebook had already made changes that sort of signaled where it was going last year. Previous to this ban, they had made it a requirement that group members for gun groups be over the age of 18, for example. They also, encourage users to comply with any local and state, state laws. Gun laws really vary state by state.
Mm-hmm.
And so Facebook, part of the reason they went to this ban in January was to make it clearer so that they didn't have to worry about what the state law was in your state or my state. And they instead just said, we're just going to put a blanket ban over it. They also operated, obviously, in many, many other countries where gun laws are different. And so for them, part of the reason they did this was to simplify everything so that it, was easier for people to follow the rules.
So some gun violence prevention advocates have called on Chuck Rossi, the director of engineering at Facebook, to be fired for his role in advocating and in creating this secret site. Gun enthusiasts have called him a Facebook patriot. Did all this come out after your story or before your story?
All this came out after my story, yeah. I mean, only the folks who were in Rossi's secret group really knew that he was doing this. I don't actually know if Facebook itself even knew that he was aware of this until I wrote my story.
And how has Facebook responded?
They haven't. So Facebook hasn't commented to me, or anyone else that I'm aware of publicly about their policy. They say that they're enforcing it the same as they were before, which is relying on user reports. And anytime they get something that's flagged, they'll remove it.
And plus, I guess, director of engineering at Facebook must be a pretty big job.
Yes. Yeah. He's a senior employee. He's been there for 8 years. He also, it's no secret at Facebook that he's the company's gun guy. He's trained his colleagues how to shoot at the local gun range that he's a member of in Silicon Valley. And he's also worked actually as a contractor for the U.S. government, trying to improve the background check system, among other things.
Hmm. So any sense about how Facebook might tweak its system in the future, or is it just going to stay as it is for now? And
it's tough to say. I mean, I've asked them that and haven't gotten a response. I think one of the things that we might see is, small tweaks in the wording of the policy. So, things like gun parts, for example, may be lumped in there because right now that's not in writing. But, I don't see anytime soon Facebook rolling back this policy. I mean, they did it in response to a lot of, pushback from advocacy groups. And I think it would be a surprise if they were to radically change it at this point.
So if I want to buy a gun, I can go on Facebook. Would it be difficult at this point to find one of these groups, or would it be relatively easy?
It's still relatively easy. Some of them are still open. Some of them, even the ones that I included in my original story back in March, are still open. The only issue now is that some of the groups are more selective in who they admit. Mm-hmm. And some of them, like I said, have gone to this secret setting. And so if you know someone in the group, you can get in relatively easy. It has gotten a little bit harder to actually locate them, though, from the outside.
Is that just because you're Matt Drange, who's written about them?
No, I think it's that way for everybody. I mean, okay. When a group goes secret, it goes secret for you and for me. I have been, since my story, I have been kicked out of some of these groups. People are certainly aware, that I'm writing about this stuff. But when a group goes secret, it goes that way for everyone.
All right. Well, Matt Drange, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Matt Drange is a technology writer for Forbes. We'll post a link to his article about gun sales and the ban on gun sales, or the apparent ban on gun sales, on Facebook on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 2011, Apple released an iPhone with a voice command app called Siri, the idea of a virtual assistant that could answer questions and perform basic functions such as texting or playing music caught on fast. Now, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and others have developed their own virtual assistant apps. The creators of the original Siri are set to move the needle again with the launch of a new interactive technology called Viv. Journalist Elizabeth Dwoskin has written about this recently for The Washington Post. She joins us by phone. Welcome, Elizabeth Dwoskin.
Thank you so much for having me.
The developers behind Viv don't work for Apple anymore. When did they leave, and what does that have to do with Viv?
Good question. They left around 2011. So Siri was an app that was acquired by Apple, by Steve Jobs personally. He actually came to the house. These guys, I mean, imagine you're like early 30s, you built this technology. They had a huge pedigree in artificial intelligence, which we can talk about, but it wasn't a huge thing then. Steve Jobs invites you to his house. You sit by the fireplace and he says, I think the virtual assistant is going to be the future of the smartphone. So they sold to Apple for reportedly over $200 million in 2010. But then quietly, the year later, they left. And now a third of the original Siri engineering team is building Viv. So they went to build probably what they always wanted to build, or at least what they discovered that they always wanted to build.
Why didn't they just stay with Apple and do it there?
So they don't like to actually comment on anything related to Apple. I think because one, it's Apple and they've signed non-disclosure agreements, and two, because of their pretty close relationship with Steve Jobs, who passed away the following year. So, but What I can surmise, if I read between the lines, is that, you know, Apple had an idea of building, if you think about what Siri can do, if you talk to Siri, a lot of Americans have talked to Siri at least once, and many more so. Many use, I think 10% of people today use voice as their primary search method, according to Google. And when you use voice, let's say you say, Siri, hey, get me a movie ticket. Siri's going to pull up a link now to Ticketmaster. It's basically a Google, it's basically, I won't say a Google search because they don't use Google, they use rival Bing, but it's a search with your voice. They just, if you say, get me a restaurant, they'll pull up the OpenTable app, but you can't actually make the reservation unless you download the app. The original technology that they had built for Siri were these integrations where you could actually do commerce. You could transact on the app. So, I'm sorry, through Siri, through your voice, you could actually transact. They call it conversational commerce. That's going to be the latest buzzword in tech. But the idea is that you could go the next step and actually buy the movie ticket, make the reservation. So you don't have to stop and go and then, you know, start toggling through an app or a mobile website and typing things. And there's a lot of clicks, a lot of another Silicon Valley parlance, friction, a lot of friction. So when I read between the lines about it, what I say is that they the original Siri that they built had those integrations, but those were taken away during the Apple acquisition, and it only became the only app Siri could talk to really smoothly were Apple's apps. And you see this a lot with the big technology giants where the things that they build only work well with the other things that they build.
Well, especially Apple, though. That's been a hallmark of theirs.
But Google has a similar thing going on with Android because Google has Gmail, Google Maps, and they exert quite a lot of pressure on companies that build that are Android makers. They exert a lot of pressure on those companies to actually download the whole suite of Google apps if they want to have access to the Play Store on their phone.
Yeah.
So there's lots of ways that it happens, not just Apple.
Yeah. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Washington Post reporter Elizabeth Dwoskin about Viv, a new app being put out there by the creators of Siri, kind of a personal assistant app that you use. All you need is your voice. Yesterday, Viv was unveiled to the public. Here is Dag Kitlaus asking Viv a question. Dag Kitlaus is one of the developers.
Will it be warmer than 70 degrees near the Golden Gate Bridge after 5 p.m. the day after tomorrow?
And what did how did Viv respond, Elizabeth Dwoskin?
Viv knew what the day after tomorrow was, and it knew what warmer was. So that's a whole language engine that they've built, and they say they're trying to patent it. But it's what they say, it's a technology that allows a greater conversational capability than technology's had in the past. So it understood warmer than, which is a phrasing, so it had to understand, and then the day before today, so it has to know the day and then know the date. So it came up then with the answer for the prediction for the day before. It said, on such and such date, it will be blah, blah, blah. So, it takes conversation to another level, or so at least that's their goal.
Does Viv have a voice, or is it all text? I mean, is it like Siri that way?
So right now, that's a really good question. I've only seen it in text, so actually it will eventually have a voice. I'll fact check myself on that, but I've only seen it in text.
Okay.
And the other thing you said is that you said they're releasing a new app, but that actually is in itself a question.
Okay.
We actually don't know what form this disembodied voice will reach the public. It's one of the biggest questions around what they're building. We don't know if they'll release it as an app. I wrote in my story for the Washington Post that ironically, the company that actually hopes to eviscerate apps, because what they want to do is create a world where you don't have to download an app anymore.
Gotcha.
But they may actually ironically be released as an app first.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's got to come like built into a phone or an app.
Well, exactly. So, but let's say if they were acquired, they might just be built into things. And also you have to think beyond phones, because this Viv technology can integrate with smart refrigerators. It can integrate with your toaster. It can integrate with your lighting. So actually what they hope is that you'll just talk to Viv to do anything. And so it won't necessarily, not everything will be based on a phone, you know,
yeah.
It could be Viv's voice through a wand in your home, like Amazon's Alexa
or Echo.
Probably wouldn't
or...
happen. Yeah. Amazon's Echo with the Alexa voice. So Amazon is really already branded Alexa. So I couldn't see them rebranding Viv, but you could just talk to it in your home. You know, so it doesn't, they're thinking beyond the phone.
Wow. And they're thinking, of course, beyond, as you point, it goes right to the point of the ability to decipher more complex speech, and the more complex, as they go on, they can just keep making it smarter.
Yeah, the more partners they have and the more data that they can work with, the smarter Viv can get. I mean, that's the same with any technology that mm-hmm. uses big data or data mining, which is just the more, just like a human being, the more knowledge you have, the more you have to draw from.
We know that Viv has a partnership with other companies like Uber and Hotels.com, but that you're thinking that's just the beginning of something bigger.
Yeah, they said that they have about 50 partnerships right now. But for these technologies to be really efficient, it's like the more things they can connect to, the better. Because the whole idea is, I'd say, hey, I'd like to get my mother flowers tomorrow, and can we take her to the opera? And by the way, if there's no opera, could you make the movie tickets? Well, just think, that would actually require, if you were going to do that today, that would actually require using multiple services, toggling between multiple services. So imagine if you could only do two of those things and not all of them, would it be as useful to you?
Mm-hmm.
So the joke I make in the story is that, you know, Somebody said it in a different way too. Somebody said Silicon Valley is a lot of brilliant engineers tackling small problems.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I say in the story, it's like, you know, the first demo that they did inside their offices of Viv was ordering pizza, mm-hmm. which they ordered pizza through Viv. So it's like they're all on this proverbial quest to order the proverbial pizza and make it one less step, which for us probably sounds pretty trivial, though, of course, if we were all talking through it with their voice, it would totally change our behavior. If, you know, it would totally change things, actually, and how we interact with technology if it happened. And it may.
Is there evidence that this is the way people want to interact with the internet, that this is what people want?
Well, that's probably the crucial question. I think the builders of the technology would say it's got to be good. And if it's not good, then people aren't going to use it. And so far, it hasn't been good enough. That said, about 10% of people use voice, as I mentioned, as their primary mode of search right now. And actually, for people under 35, millennials, they say that number is greater than that. It's like 27% use voice first. I mean, you can ask yourself in your own life, how many people do you know, or how often do you see people talking to their phones as opposed to typing?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, typing is the dominant method right now. But, you know, it's not an accident that every single big company in Silicon Valley, the big five, the giants, they all have some kind of voice or personal assistant type of investment right now. And, you know, perhaps that they all see it in some ways. You know, you also, so the question is, are many people doing it now? No, most people are using apps, but our behavior in apps is also changing. Like, there's some evidence that consumers now just spend 80% of their time in five apps. So there's more of a hurdle to download a new app. You know, apps, it's harder for an app to be sticky. So it's almost like it's slowing down, and people talk about app fatigue. Like, you have so many apps on your phone, it's so annoying to toggle between them. I still download a lot of apps, but I do see that that's really annoying often. So, yeah, what will happen in the next few years will be really interesting. I think if voice capabilities get very good, there's no reason why we wouldn't want to talk to them, because sometimes typing is a pain in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, sometimes talking is a pain in the butt if you're in a meeting.
Right.
You don't want to start talking into your phone. So I think it gives you more context. But those contexts very much affect, you know, who rules the day and who are the gatekeepers to services, to businesses and their customers. Because ultimately you're doing things that require talking to different businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And so the mode of communication really impacts that.
Well, Elizabeth Dwoskin, I assume you'll keep us posted in the future. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Elizabeth Dwoskin, she's a Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. We'll have a link to her article about Viv on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. More and more people are securing their phones with their fingerprint. It's a good, if imperfect, way to secure phone data. But choosing this method to unlock a phone can have consequences with law enforcement. Joining us now is contributing editor to AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
One of your colleagues recently wrote about this issue and about the issue of law enforcement forcing you to place your finger on your phone and unlock it. Can you explain how fingerprints are different than a passcode in this case?
Well, it's something physical that's on you. It's something, you know, it's a part of your person that's being used to unlock the phone. And so it's not something that you have to recall from memory or that you have to, it's something physical and tangible that can be seen and used.
And what about law enforcement forcing you to place your finger? Has this happened?
There have been examples of it happening in a couple of states in the U.S. where, isolated cases so far, where police officers have compelled people that have been either in custody or just pulled over on the side of the road to unlock their phone in order to gain access to information, maybe to confirm texting while driving or to access information on the phone. But there have been documented examples of it in the U.S., even over the last year.
Yeah, why is this coming to a head now?
A lot of it is because, like we had talked about a couple of weeks ago, there are a whole lot more people using their fingerprint as a security method, whereas previously these people, there was no security method in place, so the officer could just compel them to slide to unlock the phone. Because there was no password or you know, pin or anything like that in place. And so we've seen this increase in, you know, people encrypting their phones and doing important things to keep themselves a little bit more safe. But it's important to keep in mind that that your fingerprint is not a password. It is in many ways a username, and so it can be kind of compelled away from you. But there are ways to kind of mitigate that. There are ways to put yourself in a position where you can continue to use your fingerprint and not be compelled to use it to unlock your phone for someone.
Like what?
For example, every phone that has a fingerprint sensor has a security measure that makes it so that when you have rebooted your phone, the fingerprint is not enough to unlock it. You have to do something else in order to unlock it. So my colleague, Jerry Hildenbrand, who wrote the article, suggested that if you are in a situation where you are concerned about being compelled to unlock your phone, rebooting your phone before you're asked will remove that, because your fingerprint will no longer be enough to access the phone.
So after you've been in an auto accident.
As terrible as that sounds, yeah, the first thing you should think about is probably not to
turn your phone off.
Turn your phone off. But if, you know, and not necessarily a vehicular situation, just mm-hmm. if you're in a situation, even without, you know, police involvement, where you're concerned about being compelled to use your fingerprint to unlock a phone, you know, a reboot is a kind of a stopgap band-aid to that problem. But it is a larger conversation that needs to be happening is whether that's appropriate behavior, whether, you know, being compelled to use your fingerprint is something that's appropriate.
For police officers, I mean, what are you going to say to a criminal?
Right. Yeah. And you know, it's a difficult situation, I imagine, on both sides of this conversation. You know, to be the one who is compelled to do so and to make that request. I think it's, you know, because it has to be the right situation. You have to be able to justify it somehow if you are, you know, the officer doing so. And we've seen a couple of cases recently, especially the San Bernardino terrorists, where so much noise went into trying to gain access to this phone. And then it turned out there was nothing of value on it.
Well, and it turned out they did it on their own. They just hired somebody to do it anyway. They didn't have to go through.
You know, yeah, it caused a large kind of national conversation over, you know, whether it was appropriate to make this request and whether the information that was on it was something that that our government had the right to access. And then it turned out that there was no useful information to begin with, so it didn't matter.
Is this going to play out in sort of an illegal search and seizure kind of a theme or what? I mean, what are the courts – how are the courts looking at it? Do you know?
I don't know. This is kind of early days for a lot of this conversation that isn't happening, because it's important to keep in mind that that these individual cases are very, very different from what happened with the San Bernardino shooters.
Right.
You know, these are people who in one case was pulled over for, you know, speeding. You know, so it's these are very different situations, and the question becomes, at what point is it appropriate to compel someone to do something like this, to unlock their phone? And I think that conversation, you know, where that line is the conversation that's happening, not whether it should happen at all, but you know, where it becomes appropriate.
Okay. If you have anyone has a question or comment for my guest, Russell Holley, contributing editor to AndroidCentral.com, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to move on to ad blockers. They're becoming more common on our mobile devices. They've been available on browsers for some time. How do they work, Russell?
Well, in a lot of cases, when a website loads, there are a bunch of different pieces that load individually. And ads, in most cases, are a specific class of thing that gets loaded in a web browser. And so the web browser can detect those things and choose not to display them when the information is being displayed. So you get the website, and then there are just these gaps. When these ad blockers are enabled, where the ads would normally go, you know, the space is still reserved, because that's how the website was designed. But that class of thing, which can be really any part of the website, because it's broken up into all these different pieces. And in some cases, there have been apps out for a while that control where they put the control of ad blocking in the hands of the user. The user can pick individual classes and kind of block them. And some of them get as strict as removing the comment section from a website, treating it like an advertisement. So it's really complicated.
I love comment sections. I wouldn't like that.
Yeah, it's different for, you know, a lot of websites are handling this very differently. And there are some websites who have, when they detect a browser that has an ad blocker enabled, they have a separate pop-up that comes up and, tries to explain, what it is they've done or even just make it so that the website is no longer available to that user. And so it's kind of a back and forth conversation that's happening right now as to, what is the appropriate course of action? Because in a lot of cases, ads can be really intrusive on websites, depending on where you go. You know, we're kind of beyond the, 10 pop-up ads age when it comes to advertising online. But, these, depending on whether you're looking at it on your phone or on a computer, there are a lot of ads on a lot of websites that can get very intrusive.
Mm-hmm. The newest version of Opera for smartphones comes with an ad blocker built in. Is that unusual?
It's becoming a lot more common. This is something that we have seen over the last couple of months, really. Apple allowed ad blockers to exist in the App Store so that you can install separate applications that would do it. They're not implementing it on their own browser. Safari has a kind of light method that will make it so that things are smaller and therefore can load faster when you go on the website, but they don't actively give you buttons to push to say, I don't want to see that ad, I don't want to see that that content when you go to a website. But Opera and Firefox, Mozilla's Firefox, both now have tools in them that essentially give users exactly that kind of control, where you can go through and decide that you don't want to see these advertisements or you don't want to see this particular kind of content. And it's really complicated to see how it works. You go to a lot of websites and it works exactly the way that it says, where you start seeing, fewer ads, not necessarily no ads, because like I said, it's all kind of broken up into classes and some of them are different. Mm-hmm. But you do end up seeing fewer ads. And as terrible as it sounds for someone who writes on the internet all day for a living, a lot of websites end up performing faster. They load faster and do things faster as a result of not having to load some of these big complicated ads.
But they make less money.
Yes, the websites make considerably less money in those situations, and it causes the content creators, the websites owners to kind of jump through hurdles to try and put ads in different places or to make them show up a little differently so that they can kind of trick these ad blockers. And it's a bizarre kind of back and forth conversation right now. And some websites are being very aggressive about it, whereas others are just kind of looking for alternatives that make everyone happy so that there are, fewer ads or ads in more appropriate places. And then there is Google's contributor program, which replaces all of the ads on any of their websites, any of their partner websites, with pictures of cats, as long as you pay like a monthly fee for that website. Like if you pay, I think it's like $1.20 a month for Android Central, you can go and all the ads on our website are replaced with cats.
I get ads on the internet and I get why they're necessary, coming from the newspaper business, but the big pop-ups that block the whole screen practically and make you force you to search and search and search for the X is...
Oh, yeah. It's a gigantic, obnoxious pain. Some of these are very, very intrusive. Or the ones that that don't have an X, yeah, but require that you scroll a certain percentage in order for them to go away. Yeah, those are terrible.
Well, it's like gaming. I mean, it's like trying to get through a maze, on Mario Brothers. I'm trying to figure it out. How do I get out of here? How do I do this? Is there an ability to block certain kinds of ads?
Yes. It really depends on what tools you're using in order to make this happen. And again, it's never going to work exactly the same on every single website. But there are ways to allow certain kind of ads through, especially if you have a website that is getting all of their ads from specific networks that provide these ads by you know, kind of working out deals with all of these different companies, then there ends up being ways to do that. But it's every time you take that step, you know, how far can I get? You know, can I just block a little bit? You know, it becomes a lot less user-friendly in order to pull off.
And are there ad blockers for your phone?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, the ones for the iPhone and for Android phones that will go through. Samsung makes one. Opera that was just released will work on all of these things, and that's what they're geared for, is to work specifically on your phone.
Okay, let's talk about Apple Maps. It's adding a public transit info piece to the puzzle. They started to roll it out on its Maps app. This is something that could be done with Google Maps. Well, has it been done for Google Maps for some time, right? Or could have been?
It's been done for Google Maps for a couple of years now.
Okay.
Apple Maps has always kind of lagged a little tiny bit behind Google Maps when it comes to doing stuff, you know, when it comes to kind of adding new features and doing things. But Apple Maps has started rolling out a whole bunch of different options for transit directions, where you decide that you know, you want to take a bus or a train or something somewhere. And if you live in one of the new areas where this has been rolled out, then you can now see that information and kind of move to instead of driving directions or walking directions, having that information kind of added into your travel time.
I think that's really cool. They don't do it anywhere in Ohio yet, just about 20 cities so far. How do they choose what cities they're doing it with?
I think it's information that they can quickly grab that is in, you know, kind of these larger areas where a lot of that information is already pretty available. I know for Washington, D.C. is the closest one to me. There are already several great apps that will give you up to the minute information on how, you know, mass transit is running and, you know, that kind of information.
Right.
So that data is already available for Apple to kind of scoop up and add into Apple Maps to make sure that it's accurate. And I think that's why they're doing this slowly, is to ensure accuracy.
Why would someone choose Apple Maps over Google Maps with this new function?
Because it's included on their iPhone. Or because it plays nicely with Siri. If you wanted to ask Siri for directions to someplace, the first place that Siri typically looks is Apple Maps, because it's an Apple product and included on their phone.
Right.
So that would be the biggest reason. This is definitely not more functional than what Google offers through Google Maps, but it involves installing a separate app, and it doesn't play quite as well with things like Siri and some of the other Apple products.
Are there any other competitors out there for driving directions or public transit directions?
There is Nokia's Here, which is a GPS service that does turn by turn directions, but it's not as capable as Google Maps for transit directions. So it's still not something that I think most folks would choose over either of these two options. But it is an alternative that's available.
Is there a big demand for this?
I think that there is a big demand for having the ability, but not necessarily one that is enough to cause people to go looking.
Okay.
It's one of those things where if someone sees the function available on their phone, then it's a cool thing that they use. But if it's not, I don't think it occurs to a lot of people to go and look for this feature.
Because I would think if I was visiting, I assume they're mostly big cities. If I was visiting a city that I'm not really familiar with, it would be an incredible thing to have.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is something, especially with Google Maps, it's one of the first things that I go to when I go to a big city, is looking for, you know, how functional the mass transit system is, so that I can use that instead of a cab or something.
Now, Russell Holly, you recently wrote about the 5 must-have games for your Oculus Rift, the virtual reality gaming system, the thing we talk about every week now. And let's go through a couple of those, or however much time we have. Project Cars for all racing fans, you said. Why? What does it do?
Project Cars is fascinating on its own. Like, even as just a PC game, it was something that was done to be as realistic as possible when you're playing the game, which is something that people who play racing games really, really enjoy. And so having that kind of virtual reality experience, it puts you know, very much in the driver's seat, where you're looking to the left and to the right. You actually have to, you know, kind of pick your head up a little bit to look through the rear view mirror of the vehicle that you're in, or to look through the side mirrors. And it gives you that exact experience. You know, you're looking through the side mirror to see the vehicle that's beside you as you're racing. And so it's an incredibly immersive experience that I'm not a huge racing fan, but I deeply appreciated feeling like I was actually in the vehicle while I was driving.
And it's $50.
It is, which is pretty standard for, kind of new games.
Okay.
Be they for PC or Xbox.
Okay. And then Adrift. It's the disembodied adventure in space. That sounds fun to me.
It is a ton of fun, but it's also really scary.
Oh, okay.
I forgot the name of the movie. Goodness.
Would that be Gravity?
Gravity. Yeah. This is basically Gravity the game, where you are kind of floating around in a space station, and something terrible happens to the space station, and so you are experiencing, trying to survive in that environment as you try and do things. And so you have this very weightless feel as you are in a spacesuit, kind of doing things, which is a little weird given that you're not actually weightless and you can still feel your body, kind of tethered to the ground.
Yeah.
So it's not quite as immersive as some of the other experiences, but it's a visually very compelling story that gets told. And if you are the kind of person who really gets sucked into these kind of stories, like someone sitting and watching Gravity, with all the lights off and the volume up,
yeah,
it is very easy to kind of feel that panic, like something is actually happening to you.
I think that would be really interesting because I would never in a million years go out into space.
Right, so, absolutely.
Yeah. That's just $20.
Yeah, it's a smaller game. It's really not a full game, and it was built specifically for these kind of that kind of detached experience where you kind of felt like you were drifting. Even before virtual reality headsets came out, it got a lot of praise for just feeling very real.
Well, it's as close as I'll ever get to being Sandra Bullock, I guess. So, Kronos.
Kronos is interesting as a role playing game.
Okay.
For really any platform, but especially in virtual reality, in that you play a character who is going through this kind of dungeon and doing things. But when your character quote unquote dies, instead of crumpling to the ground and having to start over a few steps back or something like that, you actually go all the way back to the beginning of the puzzle, and your character has aged a year. So
Ooh.
When you get to a certain point, if you have died a certain amount of times, then it actually becomes impossible for the character that you've created to solve the puzzle, because you're now, an old man or an old woman, and are unable to complete some of the challenges. So you lose kind of all of the progress that you've had and end up having to start over. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really interesting.
So start over.
Yes. Like build an entirely new character.
Wow. That sounds interesting.
It was really kind of fascinating, to be from the very beginning, think about there being kind of lasting consequences for the stuff that you're doing.
We are out of time. There are more. If you want to learn more about what Russell thinks about the 5 must-have games for your Oculus Rift, you can go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Russell Holly, thanks as always for your help today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
It's Russell Holly. He's a contributing editor to AndroidCentral.com. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.